Introducing set number 1009, C.G. Jung's Seven Sermons to the Dead, this is a BC Recordings copyrighted full-length lecture presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung and the Gnostics.
There are quite a sizable number of people, particularly in the Jungian community, who have discovered the Gnostics and Gnosticism by way of Jung and his interests. There is a much smaller number who have come to Jung by way of the Gnostics, and I number myself among them, because quite a long time ago, in fact at the age of about 12 and a half, I discovered in some books something about the Gnostics, and I have been hunting them down ever since, and I still am. And fairly early in the game, when I was going to the university in Innsbruck in Austria, I encountered the interesting and certainly informative truth that I shared this intense interest in Gnostics and Gnosticism with the venerable old gentleman across the Alpine peaks on the other side of the border in Switzerland, namely C.G. Jung. Because it was at that time that I also encountered for the first occasion in my life Jung's curious and creative little poetic treatise, The Seven Sermons to the Dead, in the privately published edition, which was the only one in which it was available at that time, which was only given out to some friends of Jung probably in the early 1920s. And a gentleman whom I met at that time had a copy of it. And I copied it down by hand and carried it around with me all over the ocean to America and all of that, never thinking that eventually in the 1980s, or maybe it was early 1990s, I would receive an original copy from Carl Jung's son, Franz Jung, in appreciation of some of my work for the memory of his father. So now I have an original copy of the Seven Sermons to the Dead, just the same kind of copy that I saw at the tender age of 19, I think, first in the Alps. Jung, coming to his parting of the ways with Sigmund Freud, began a great and extremely intense sort of interior transformational journey, which, at least in its full intensity, lasted from about late 1912 or early 1913 to 1916, about 3.5 years, and that within that period of time, he said, describing his experience, that he descended into the underworld like Orpheus and other heroes of old. He underwent his Nekia, and that he communed with all sorts of mysterious and awesome forces, as he named them, of the unconscious at that time, and that these forces and images and inspirations, the substance of whose communication he had written down in 1,330 handwritten pages, which are still extant in manuscript form but never have been published, in something that is called the Red Book, because he had them bound in red leather, that this material in many ways served as the basic inspirational source material for a great deal of his subsequent psychological scientific work. He stated this unequivocally toward the end of his life. At the conclusion of these 3.5 years, of these 3.5 years of intense involvement with his inner life and with the mysteries of the soul, just as he was emerging from that period, a kind of resounding concluding experience came to him, which resulted in the writing down of the so-called Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, which is the Latin title, meaning the seven sermons to the dead. The way that occurred, you can find descriptions of it in Jung's autobiographical fragments, Memories, Dreams and Reflections, edited by Aniela Jaffe, and also increasingly allusions to it are found in many different sources. Jung felt that something was about to happen. He was in his house in Zurich with his children and his wife, and sort of the psychic atmosphere became increasingly charged, as that often occurs before important revelations of the unconscious, shall we say. Even his children were having strange dreams, and then one day, I think toward evening, his doorbell rang very powerfully and violently, and when we say doorbell, we don't have to imagine a sort of little electric buzzer like we have here, but rather a bell that really takes some yanking and pulling in order to make it ring, one of these nice big hand-drawn doorbells. The doorbell rang violently. Jung went to the door, looked out, and saw no one. And while he did not see anyone, he heard many voices whispering in the air. And they said, "We have come from Jerusalem, where we did not find that which we were seeking." And with that, he said, the spirits were in the house. There are conflicting reports about the amount of time. According to some people, in one night. According to others, over a 2 days and night period, Jung wrote down these seven beautiful, poetic, and certainly very psycho-spiritually and symbolically charged little chapters of a work that he called the Seven Sermons to the Dead. The only reason that I'm beginning my little discourse this evening with an account of these happenings is that the Seven Sermons to the Dead was really for a very long time and also was the very first evidence of Jung's intense and intimate involvement with Gnostic lore. Because the Seven Sermons to the Dead are written entirely in the style and using the symbolic language and sort of mythic framework of early, probably second or third century Gnosticism. It was, of course, rumored all through the many years of Jung's life that he was very close to this early variant of the Christian religion, known as Gnosticism, but he did not make really any statements of an overt nature about it in public. Since the writing of the Seven Sermons to the Dead, till clear right up around his 80th year, when indeed on his 80th birthday he was presented with an original Gnostic codex, the first codex, codex number one of the now reasonably well-known and translated Nag Hammadi Library of Gnostic Scriptures, that first codex or book having been named after him and still is known as that, as the Jung Codex, which was presented to him on his 80th birthday in a public gathering in Switzerland. And when Jung held in his 80-year-old, somewhat unsteady hands this ancient writing, then he gave a fairly lengthy speech, which speech is contained, incidentally, for your information, in volume 18 of Jung's collected writings. And there he quite unabashedly, once again, and publicly owned up to his tremendous interest in and involvement with, and indeed his internal and abiding devotion to this particular ancient school of thought. Subsequently, of course, as particularly after his death, when his autobiographical fragments came out and then various other people began writing biographies of him, in practically all of these, some reference to his involvement with Gnostics and with Gnosticism appeared. For instance, one of his close disciples, all of them, with one or two exceptions by now, are of course also dead, Barbara Hanna, in her biography of Jung, shares with us a great many personal statements that Jung made to her and sometimes to a smaller group of people wherein she found herself. And there are several statements there, but one where he stated very specifically that when he encountered the writings of the Gnostics early in his life, he immediately felt that he was among old friends. And then, of course, let's say all of his ensuing interest in these matters can be really traced back to that. It is also well known now, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself in terms of some later discussions that we may have, that Jung really only began his interest in alchemy, which became a very, very important sort of paradigmatic symbol system for his psychology from a certain time on. I think his first alchemical book, which was probably Psychology and Alchemy, major work, was published in the early 1950s in German. He only really came around to alchemy and developed that great interest in alchemy because by the end of the 1940s, in the 1930s probably already, he had exhausted the then existing original literature that had come down to us that was available from Gnostic sources. The famous Nag Hammadi library, the first codex of which was presented to him on his 80th birthday, was not really discovered until the latter part of the 1940s, 1945, 1946, thereabouts, and did not start being translated until the 1950s. And so Jung was seeking a continuation. Jung was seeking the ongoing connection that existed between second, third, fourth century Gnostic wisdom and the present time. And that is when he discovered alchemy, and on the basis originally again of some dreams that he had about alchemy, alchemical dreams, and sort of the revelation came to him inwardly, which he soon managed to substantiate by external historical research, that alchemy was the living connection between the ancient Gnostics and the later period, including the present day. So we can see that the various symbolic systems of archaic wisdom, which Jung came to utilize for the purposes of paradigms for psychological processes and psychological insight, such as alchemy, Western alchemy. From Western alchemy, he moved to some degree also onto Chinese alchemy as the result of his connection with Richard Wilhelm, the great Chinese scholar who came back to Europe after many years of residence in China and who was an acquaintance of Jung and subsequently died then in Europe, and Jung gave a speech at his funeral even. And other cognate disciplines were all the result of his initial interest in the Gnostics. Now, it's important by now, even though many of you have various degrees and kinds of information on the subject already, I am sure, to begin to make some statements about the Gnostics themselves. Now, what we need to keep in mind is again something about Jung himself, that obviously from his childhood onward, and certainly including that incredibly powerful, intense transformational period there just before 1920, Jung was a man of great and powerful internal psycho-spiritual experiences. He was a man of experience. He was that rare bird in Western culture, in modern Western culture, let's say, and you certainly can include the so-called postmodern period in that too, whatever that means. I've been trying to figure it out for years. I still don't know what postmodern really is, but it's such a sonorous word. So, you know, why not use it even if we don't know its meaning? Wouldn't be the only meaningless word that we use, I'm sure. He was one of these rare birds in our culture who put experience before theory, and indeed who, developed theories on the basis of experience, particularly his own, and then of course also of people he was associated with and who were delving into the mysteries of the psyche along the lines of research that he had indicated and outlined. Now, as I just mentioned, this is not a frequent phenomenon in our culture. It would seem that for a long, long time, for almost 2,000 years, we have really been moving away from experience as the basis of theory. And Jung himself and some of his brilliant students, like Erich Neumann, for instance, the great man who developed what might be called Jungian psychohistory, have given us some, I think, fairly plausible indications as to why this has been happening in our culture. Our Western culture, beginning sort of with its Mediterranean sources and roots among the Greeks ever since that time, has been a culture of the differentiating mind. In Western culture, we developed, perhaps for the first time in human history, to the full extent, the human ego. And this ego development is of tremendous importance, and it influences everything in the culture. Whatever their great virtues might be, other cultures that are still with us, such as the great cultures of Asia, of China, of Japan, of India, of Southeast Asia, and so forth, are all relatively uninterested in the development of the ego. Whereby now I mean the psychological ego as Jung understands it. Also, we might say that ancient cultures which have gone by the wayside, such as all the cultures, let's say, of ancient Persia and Babylon and Egypt and the Mesoamerican cultures and so forth, also seem to have been singularly lacking in ego development on any large scale. But Western culture almost specialized in that. And of course, one of the ruling principles, one of the most important functions of that ego is the thinking function. The thinking function, more perhaps than the other functions of the ego that Jung was talking about, such as the function of sensation, the function of feeling, function of intuition, the thinking function has a way, because it is the meaning-bestowing function of the ego, as Jung called it. It's by way of thinking that we are seeking for meaning. Whether we'll ever find it is another question, but we are certainly seeking it, we are trying to develop it. So the thinking function, once it develops within the ego, has a powerful tendency to sort of take over and become the leader. And it does this to a large extent by really sort of creating its own reality. There is, I think, a biblical saying, as a man thinketh, but also it says thinketh in his heart. But then the ancients, the ancient Greeks, and within that period, really, you know, they felt that the seat of consciousness was in the heart, not in the head. Which is also true of the American Indians, for instance. When Jung met the famous Indian chief in New Mexico, I think of the Pueblo Indians, the Indian chief told him, you know, doctor, the white man is crazy. And Jung said, yes, and, you know, I became a psychiatrist for that very reason. And, you know, the white man is crazy. Jung says, well, yes, I know, but why do you think so? You know, he said, well, because the white men assert that they think with their heads. He says, everybody knows that one thinks with one's heart. People who have to think with their head go crazy. This was the Indian chief's statement. So, you know, we see the man thinketh in his heart, or otherwise so is he. So we have a tendency in Western culture to elevate thinking and the product of thinking, which is intellectual theory, to a very, very high level of importance. We deify theory. And we regard intellectual theories as having an imperative reality of their own. We feel that ideas are real in their own right. But this was not always the case. So in the early period, when Western civilization just had its early beginnings, there were still a fairly large number of people who, while they certainly valued the cognitive tool known as thinking, felt that theory needs experience as its foundation. And that when theory becomes divorced from experience, it becomes unreal. Now, modern science, especially applied science, tried in its own way to somewhat get away from this excessive theorizing by saying that scientific theories need validation in terms of experimental proof. In other words, first you have a hypothesis, and then the hypothesis becomes a theory, but all along you need to bring the theory back to the level of the laboratory in order to validate the hypothesis, validate the theory. Of course, often this is not possible. And it's certainly not possible with psychology. That is why psychology never became an exact science like physics. Mm-hmm. In any event, so in this early period of our culture, and we are talking about the first few centuries of the Christian era, the first, the second, third, fourth century, there were still a lot of people around who felt that spiritual, what nowadays we would call psycho-spiritual theories, which are embodied in religion, in mythology, in disciplines of that sort, can be experienced. They don't have to be merely a matter of speculation. And soon after its beginnings, for instance, the early Christian religious communities were split sort of down the middle among people who were satisfied with theory in religion, in the religious worldview, and this theory subsequently came to be known as faith or belief. And on the other hand, people who felt that religious truths can be and indeed must be experienced. Now, these experimentalists, experiencers, were known as Gnostics. Because the Greek word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, means knowledge, but not primarily theoretical, abstract knowledge, but rather knowledge arrived at by way of interior, spiritual, intuitive experience. No doubt this attitude to some degree and to some extent was carried forward throughout history by the great mystics of Western culture. And certainly here we have to include Middle Eastern culture because, for instance, once Islam rose to a big religion and so forth, certainly Islam had its mystics and has them today too. And so we have Christian, Muslim, from the older Middle Eastern matrix, Jewish and Zoroastrian mystics. And among these people, of course, the experience was always a very important issue. But then how many people in a culture at any one given time were mystics? Very few. And the normative attitude towards spiritual things has been one of belief, or as it's euphemistically called, faith. Even today, you can very often see in a newspaper, a magazine, or a book or somewhere referring to some religious person, people will call them men or women of faith. It's just assumed that religion has to do with faith. And it was the great American philosopher William James who said, well, so very often what people mean by having faith is really having faith in someone else's faith. You know, William James was actually one of these people who stood right historically at the threshold when psychology was emerging out of being a branch of philosophy and became what it is today, a much more experimental discipline. And William James was acquainted with the depth psychologist. There was a famous meeting between William James and Freud. I don't remember because it must have been at the time when Jung was in this country also, which would have been about 1909, I think, something like that. When Jung, Freud, and the Hungarian psychoanalyst Sándor Ferenczi came to this country, and they went initially to Worcester, Massachusetts, to a little private university called Clark University, where Freud delivered a number of lectures. Then Jung went on to New York, to Fordham University and others. In any event, so William James was acquainted with these people. But so James's ironic definition, of course, is very true, because what we end up with is something that I think Theodor Rosak called substitutional experience. This means that you don't have your own experience, but you substitute the account of someone else's experience for your own, and then you believe in that. You say, well, you know, that I have a reliable account from some reliable person that they had this experience, and that proves something, so I'm going to believe in that. Jung never could go along with that kind of reasoning. Listen, for instance, to a statement which he actually gave to a journalist and was printed in the February 14, 1955 issue of Time magazine, which is sort of a sacred scripture of American culture, you know, along perhaps with the Reader's Digest. If the Reader's Digest is perhaps the Old Testament of American culture, Time magazine is maybe kind of the New Testament, although it's gradually becoming old hat, I think, too. Anyway, that's where it was. So in a rather simple-minded fashion, this particular reporter asked Jung if he believed in God. And Jung said, I can't say I believe, I know. And then he appended a little explanatory statement. I have had the experience of being gripped by something that is stronger than myself, something that people call God. Now, this is, one can say that, I think, without any qualification, just about a Gnostic statement. People who think this way have the attitude that is very, very similar to these early practitioners of the Christian religion, whose analogues we find, say, to some degree, among the Jews as Kabbalists, among the Muslims as Sufis, although, of course, one has to allow for differences. And it is the attitude of a person who strives for, and as the result of powerful and continuous striving, of course, eventually is the partaker of interior transcendental experience. So this kind of attitude, for instance, which is manifest in this short statement of Jung's that I just read, really forms the basis of Jung's attitude toward religion, and what maybe nowadays is often euphemistically called spirituality. I never can quite figure out what that means either, because somehow religion to me is a time-honored good word, while maybe it has been grossly perverted by a lot of people who thought that they were practicing religion, but you know, it just means religere in Latin, to join yourself back or together with a greater reality, and that effort is a religious effort. So that's a good enough word, I think. In any event, this was Jung's attitude toward religion, toward spirituality. That inasmuch as these efforts lead to or motivate people toward the personal experience of something greater than their ordinary selves, then this is very, very valuable. And indeed, it is a very, very valuable part and instrument of the psychological development of each and every person. Jung spoke, therefore, quite early in his career in very positive terms about religion, quite contrary to Freud, who had no use for religion at all. Freud wrote several treatises in which he just lambasted religion in a very forceful manner. One of them was significantly entitled, this is Freud now, The Future of an Illusion. That was the future of religion, because religion was an illusion. Another one was Freud's treatise on obsessive acts and religious practices, wherein he pretty much established the thesis that religion is full of obsessional neuroses, that if people become obsessive-compulsive in their own lives, then eventually they get hauled away to the institution. But if they all get together and do these crazy things as a group and call it a religion, then they get away with it. Now, this was Freud's view, but Jung's was not. And while Jung certainly recognized that there is a lot of muddle-headedness and kind of primitive thinking that is covered under the religious umbrella, that on the whole, the religious effort, the religious instinct is very, very basic to the human being. And the reason for this is, of course, that whether we know it or not, whether we understand it or not, whether we consciously are able to cooperate with such a process or not, we are all really trying to grow up spiritually. We may think that it's other things that we want to do. We may think that what we are interested in is power or money or things of that description. Those two probably pretty well cover it. In the modern era, money is power. Earlier on, it was something else. How many cows you had, how much land you had, how many wagons of potatoes you could grow in a year, but now it's money. Or even other things, prestige, beauty, so forth. But what we really want deeply within, even unbeknownst to our conscious ego, is to grow up spiritually. And that this growing up in turn consists in an integrative movement. So it's not just a unilateral movement from point A to point B, as, I don't know, one might envision the growth of a flower to be or something. There is the seed, and then the seed opens up, and the stalk grows, and it grows to a highest point that it can grow. In Southern California, without any rain, that point is not very high, generally. It's pretty short. But in any event, you know, it's not a unilateral, unidirectional growth, but rather it's an integrative growth. And the objective of it is not so much a particular fixed point that you can point toward, but rather the objective of it is wholeness, wholeness, totality. That we are lacking in wholeness. And as we go on in life, our internal sort of directing power is trying to lead us into ways wherein that wholeness will come to us. So the purpose is not necessarily or primarily or exclusively, say, to become good, namely from ethical imperfection to ethical perfection. That's something else that may be connected with this at certain point. Certainly people who grow up spiritually hardly ever become nastier people than they have been prior to their spiritual growth. But the objective of their growth doesn't seem to be that ethical development. That is an epiphenomenon, an after effect, rather than anything else. And any number of other objectives of that sort. Learning, the amassing of facts, knowing about a lot of data of one kind or the other. Again, if it comes about, again, it is an after effect of an interior wholeness. So what we are really striving for, what we are moving toward, is this kind of wholeness. So deeply within us, says Jung, from the time practically that we are born, certainly from the time that ego formation takes place, which generally is assumed to take place sort of around the age of 3 and 4, by 4 it's pretty well complete, we have an innate dissatisfaction with our condition. We feel that we are lacking in something. We know that things are not the way they ought to be. And we are looking around trying to fill that empty space within us. We can say to fulfill ourselves, to lead a fuller life, whatever we may wish to call it. But this creative dissatisfaction is within us. And now we are looking for various modalities and instrumentalities that may assist us in that process. And Jung said the most powerful of these are the ones that address themselves to what already Freud called the unconscious. Why? Because this unconscious is the gateway to wholeness. After all, we all have some degree of consciousness. Even the most unconscious of us are at least partially conscious. We all have met, I'm sure, a heck of a lot of really unconscious people. You know, it's not difficult to meet them. They are all around. Occasionally, we may have even looked into the mirror and saw someone not terribly conscious there gazing back at us, but we quickly averted our gaze and thought of something else, because that's a very uncomfortable notion. But let's say whoever is around in the world, you know, has some consciousness. We all come out of, you know, sort of a great unconscious matrix, said Jung, very much like our physical body emerges from the body of our mothers at the time of birth. So we are born into this daylight world of consciousness out of a great mystery, and we become a little ego and we begin to move around and become more and more interested in the external world and all of that. But the farther we move away from that source, also the more that unease begins to grow within us, that something is not quite right, that we are not quite whole, not quite total, and that the wholeness or totality remains a desirable objective to be achieved, even if it is done sort of preconsciously moving in that direction. Now, Jung, when looking around for models of reality in various systems, present and past, at his time, soon found that there was practically only one group of people whom he had some information about, and he didn't have an awful lot, who seemed to think of these issues very much like he thought. Although, of course, they, having lived, say, in the 3rd century, and Jung lived in the 20th century, they used different terms, a different language to express their interest and to depict their model of reality, but that they were still saying virtually, if not exactly, the same things. and that these people were the so-called Gnostics or Gnostikoi in the early period of the Christian religion. And so Jung saw that model, and he was encouraged thereby. He didn't have a great deal of first-hand information available, because, of course, the story was, as Professor Elaine Pagel so beautifully depicted in her very lucid little book that was published in the late 1970s, I think, The Gnostic Gospels, that when it came up to sort of about the 4th century and thereafter, the majority of the Christian communities became disaffected with the Gnostics, largely for political and really mercenary reasons, and declared them heretics and threw them out of the church, so that these people had to go underground. It wasn't really until about the 5th century or so, certainly the 500s, which that would make it early 6th century, when if there were still such people around, they started burning them at the stake. Up to that time, they would just chase them out and said, go away, you know. Beginning with the Spanish bishop and Gnostic practitioner in the 500s or so, Priscillan of Avila in 500, early 500 or so. He was the first one that we know of, and they really burned at the stake. And then after that, you know, like every custom like that, once it gets going, it catches on. And then it goes, same way, you know, with the Nazis also. First they would just round up a few people in the concentration camps, then some more, then they started shooting them, and that proved to be very kind of too much work. So then they eventually came up with the gas chambers. It's always the same story. Once a habit like that catches on, then it becomes more and more prevalent. So in any event, Jung saw that relationship, and when he looked at the scriptures, especially the few original scriptures that were still available of these people, because most of the literary material was destroyed, hidden away. But there were a few that were available in Jung's time, and he looked at these and he said, this is not philosophy, as we understand philosophy, say from among the Greeks, you know. Neither is this religious scripture such as we maybe find in the Old Testament or so forth, certainly very different from old Jehovah bellowing in the Old Testament and telling his followers to now slay this bunch of people, now slay that bunch of people and so forth. This is a different species. In other words, it's not just a different religion, such as you would say, well, Islam is a different religion from Christianity, but it is not only different in kind, but it is as different as a tree is from a fish or a cat. You know? We are dealing with a different phenomenon. And he said that these scriptures appear to be the accounts of people who have experienced great, powerful, mysterious, transformative things, which Jung said people to some degree at least are experiencing things like that today. He says, I have encountered experiences of this sort. I know what they are. And some of my patients and some of my friends have encountered them in dreams, in active imagination, in visions, in various altered states of consciousness. I know what these people are talking about, because I have been there, and I know people who have been there. That was his great affinity with the Gnostics. Now, here is, for instance, I think, a good quintessential statement, which sort of indicates to us how scholarship, in this case, really the discipline of the historian, looks at the present time at Jung's connection with the Gnostics. This is from a work by an Italian scholar, Giovanni Filoramo, entitled The History of Gnosticism. Here Filoramo writes, Jung's reflections had long been immersed in the thought of the ancient Gnostics to such an extent that he considered them the virtual discoverers of depth psychology. It was Jung himself who promoted the famous meetings at Ascona, that's also in the Italian part of Switzerland, annual conferences attended by some of the greatest specialists in Gnostic thought, including Gilles Quispel, a Dutch scholar deeply attached to Jungian psychology. In his works, Professor Quispel helped to construct a bridge between ancient and modern gnosis, inasmuch as it involves research into the ontological self, a cognitive technique that anticipates the modern process of individuation, ancient gnosis, albeit in its form of universal religion, in a certain sense prefigured and at the same time helped to clarify the nature of Jungian spiritual therapy. All right. Now, again, I don't want you to leave here this evening without some, at least having received some basic definition of what this Gnosticism was all about. What was it that Jung felt so close to, and indeed, what is it today? In most books, encyclopedias, and things of that sort, which are not always the most informative things in the world, and one needs some background sometimes to interpret them accurately, you will find the statement, which is not entirely inaccurate, that while conventional mainstream religiosity, let's say of a Christian, Jewish, and probably Islamic provenance, looks to salvation through faith, the Gnostics look to salvation through knowledge. Now, as I say, this is both inaccurate and accurate. It is accurate when one understands what kind of knowledge we are talking about. I mentioned, I think, earlier that the Greek word gnosis does not mean knowledge of fact or even of philosophical truth, but rather a super-intellectual and super-sensible interior cognition of transcendental realities. So what we mean thereby is that the Gnostics felt that human beings had within them the capacity not only to read or to listen to divine revelation, as we find, I don't know, in the Bible, in the Quran, and so forth, and then try to follow that, which is the position of most mainstream religiosity, for that matter of Hindu and Buddhist provenance too, the Vedas or so forth, you know. These are all very bookish religions, you know. You know that all you need to do to be a Hindu is to believe in the Vedas, that the Vedas are sacred revelation. Otherwise, you have a great deal of latitude. Of course, it helps to be born in India, too, because for a long time it was not considered kosher for anybody to even study the Hindu religion who was not born in India. It wasn't until the late 19th century with people like Swami Vivekananda and so forth who became sort of... They had all these stupid Christian missionaries coming to India bothering them, and then finally they said, you know what, we're going to return the favor. So they started sending missionaries to the West. And of course, that's why I always have a little bit my doubts about the Swamijis and Gurujis and so forth, because I feel, you know, it never was the elite, the best, let's say, of the Christian clergy that went to these places and became a missionary. We were usually the misfits and the freaks. What guarantee do we have that the same thing is not true with these people who are coming this way? You know, so I'm always a little bit afraid of that. However, that is not the subject of our discussion. So the Gnostic belief was that the human has within himself, within herself, the capacity of a direct apprehension of the spiritual realities. Doesn't have to be satisfied with faith in a book or in someone else's experience. That's sort of the central dividing line. You can see how it's very compatible with Jung's thought too, because the spiritual growth and individuation has to be undertaken by the individual. The individual has that capacity. If that capacity were for such spiritual growth were not within the individual, there would not be any individuation process. But on the other hand, and this is also rather important to keep in mind, and some people, some very learned people at times don't keep this in mind, that just like Jung said, yeah, everybody is trying to individuate, And there are certainly a fair number of people who managed to get there eventually to some degree on their own. But most people really, especially in our present world, in our present culture, need some help. And that's what he was trying to do. That's what he was trying to train other analysts in analytical psychology to do. The Freudian analyst is supposed to be, that is his calling really, the facilitator of the individuation of people. Not a head shrinker who tries to fix people's problems. So that you're going to be a little bit less crazy, and therefore you'll be able to function in this crazy world a little bit better, or whatever the case may be. Because that's why most people run to a psychologist or the psychoanalyst too, because, well, doctor, I'm maladjusted. I can't really function in this crazy world. Well, what leads you to believe that your inability to function in an insane world means that you are insane? Maybe the world is insane. Eh? That's what more of them should say to them, but of course that's not the way it usually works. But the Gnostics also said that there is help available. So they interpreted religion as being the various frameworks within which the help from higher sources comes to people to help them to develop this salvific, transformative knowledge of their own. And they looked upon Jesus, for instance, as such a helper. And so, while to the ordinary mainstream Christians, the important thing became that Jesus died on the cross, and they said, well, that's what saves people, so people have to believe in that. The Gnostics said, what about the Jesus who lived rather than the one who died? What about the things that he said? What about the mysteries that he conveyed to his disciples? What about the help that he gave people so that they could become liberated, that they could become saved from ignorance, darkness, and the involvement in unconsciousness? Now, of course, none of this was very palatable to the mainstream Christian people. So, however, in order to, what did the existentialists used to call this sort of thing, transvaluation, which is a good word. You know, those boys had a lot of good ideas. In order to, let's say, transvalue religious preachments and religious concepts in these terms, in order to have a religion of psychological growth, of psychological transformation, the Gnostics had to reinterpret and transvalue a lot of the religious scriptures and a lot of the things that people believed, because they were all slanted by them to the other view. It's very difficult, for instance, to believe in the Old Testament God. You know? To take all of that cruel, punitive, dark sort of stuff that is really through the Old Testament. I wouldn't let little children read that stuff. I'd rather have them read Stephen King or Edgar Allan Poe. It's less scary than, you know, the stuff in much of the Old Testament. It's awful. So it's very difficult to say that this God desires anyone's growth of consciousness, because he hasn't done anything of that sort. What he demanded was obedience to his will. But there's very little promotion of individual consciousness and personal sovereignty, individual gnosis around there. Now, when you come to the New Testament, it's different. So the Gnostics said, ironically, don't pay any attention to that God. That God was not the real God. It was a lesser God. It was sort of an intermediate kind of a being who wasn't necessarily such a bad fellow, but he wasn't very bright. He was just very big, you know. But he wasn't very much more enlightened than the people he was talking to. He was just much, much larger and much more powerful. There's a lot of evidence for that sort of thing if you want to look at it that way. For instance, you look at Job, the book of Job, and Job's arguments with God. And of course, Jung, in typical Gnostic fashion, wrote about that in his book Answer to Job, and Jung came to the conclusion, like the old Gnostics, that Job was a much nicer and much better and much wiser fellow than the God he was talking to. You know? Job could have taught that God a few things rather than the other way around. And all the big fellow could say, well, who are you to talk to me like that? Where were you when I made the mountains? Where were you when I made the... And then he brags about, where were you when I created the crocodile? Now, you know, that really fixed it with me. Anybody who brags about creating a crocodile, I'll have my doubts about. The nastiest, the ugliest, the most vile and off-putting creature probably on this earth. And to brag about that, not a good sign, folks. Coincidence? I don't think so. There is something bad about that. In any event, so the Gnostics essentially said in reinterpreting these concepts that this sort of unconscious God image, so concerned with enforcing its will, and so little concerned really with making people grow and thereby becoming better, is not the ultimate reality. That it's an intermediate reality and that people should work their way through to something higher than that. Now you can see how that would have appeared very heretical to people. And Jung always said, well, you know, I don't know about these things, about these gods up there. So although in answer to Job, he took a little different attitude. On the whole, he always said, I'm a psychologist. I will not pass any judgment as to what goes on among the gods and the angels. And so, because that's outside of the scope of a psychologist's research. But I can tell you that inside of you, there exists powers and potentialities which are very analogous to these. And so what do you think that Jung and in his system is analogous to this Jehovah of the Old Testament, this God who says, I am the only God and there is no other God beside me? It's the human ego. We have our own little Jehovah. And it comes up and it creates its own world. You created your own world, I create my own world, we create a real world around us. Some of it isn't all that real. Some of it isn't all that good. And most of it isn't all that wise, but we still create it, you know. And it works, sort of. Our world that we make for ourselves works sort of, rather like this external world works sort of, you know. You can get all excited like Isaac Newton or so about how all this great wonderful machine, you know, all these stars and everything and how they don't really bump into each other and all of that. Now and then they get a black hole, but so what, you know. And you know, it's all so wonderful, it all works together so well. But then when you look at it close at hand, you see, well, what about AIDS? You know? What about these horrible things that happen? And they are somehow part of the fabric of this world too. What about Adolf Hitler? What about Joseph Stalin? You know, why do we get these people? Why in the dickens have they been created? Well, maybe for the same reason as the crocodile. And so we have somebody who will eat us up. Or even, if you want to go even further, that we really live in a world when it comes right down to it where everything is constantly eating everything else. And you can't really remove yourself from it. I have a lot of friends, and I tried that route too at one time, somewhat to my own misery, you know, vegetarians. Oh well, I'll remove myself, you know, I won't eat any animals. But as Joseph Campbell said once when we were talking about the same thing, he says, have you heard the carrot scream? He says, you know, they do, you know. So what leads you to believe that vegetables are not unhappy that you pull them out and that you eat them? It's true. It's just they can't scream as loud as a rabbit. Rabbits can really scream, believe you me, or a pig. So what are you going to do? You're going to starve yourself to death? And meanwhile, there are all kinds of things, mostly little ones, so you can't even go after them. They're coming and they're trying to eat you. So it's really a rather off-putting situation. Now the ego makes its own world, which looks pretty good to the ego, like this world looks pretty good to Jehovah. But you know, they are both rather flawed. And so what needs to be done is to get beyond the ego. When the ego can be enlightened, can reestablish its connection with a greater reality beyond itself, which Jung calls the self with the capital S, that is the true God in the psyche, then the whole thing begins to work differently. But the alienated ego is just like an alienated God who thinks he is the only God and there is no other. And so Jung saw in the way the Gnostics reinterpreted the biblical scriptures and so forth, he saw psychological analogs. And he said, if we apply these principles to ourselves, then we find that psychologically they make sense. And that what these old folk back in the second, third centuries and so-called gnosis, this unitive knowledge which unifies, which integrates, and which reconnects us with a greater reality, this is really the individuated state. So Jung saw a psychological gnosis, a psychological application of these ancient principles, but I hasten to add that just because he did this, and wrote about it in great and often very practical detail, doesn't really mean that he had no regard and respect for the metaphysical or the transcendental dimensions of these teachings, only that was not really his job to comment about. Except in a few instances, pretty much toward the end of his life, such as Answer to Job and a few other smaller treatises, which are not really strictly psychological treatises, although they are always informed, of course, by the psychological discipline, but where he sort of developed his own gnosis. I won't have the opportunity to comment on them in any detail, but I have here a few points, in fact, 12 of them, and they are only a sentence each. These were put together by a professor from the University of Miami a few years ago, Clark Emery, where he sort of summarized in 12 points the principal teachings of the Gnostics. Now, I'll read these off to you, and I'll sort of let you form your own conclusions about the psychological applications of these, although maybe I'll throw in a word or two. Number one, they posited an original spiritual unity which came to be split into a plurality. Let me just throw in. We ourselves come from a state of unity, but the further out we go into differentiation, the more part selves, autonomous complexes we develop, and we are now a plurality rather than a unity. Second, as a result of this pre-cosmic division, the universe was created. It was created by a leader, Archon in Greek, possessing inferior spiritual powers, a leader often having the appearance of the Old Testament God. I spoke of this before. The psychological analog of this would be the ego. Third, a female emanation from God was involved in another way in the cosmic creation. Jung always spoke. Anima and animus. And the unconscious wisdom having a feminine tone. So this feminine wisdom was there from the beginning. It is referred to as Sophia. Fourth, in the cosmos, space and time have a malevolently spiritual character and may be personified as ambivalent or demonic beings separating the human from God. Space and time separate us from the authentic reality until we see through them. Extraversion of consciousness, as Jung would call it. Fifth, for the human, the universe is a vast prison. He is enclosed both by the physical laws of nature and by such psychic laws as the Mosaic Code. Well, yes, until we are individuated, until this integrative individuational process takes place, we are imprisoned. Consciousness is imprisoned in physicality. When you strike out, you get angry and you hit somebody in the face, and you didn't even feel like doing it to begin with, just, you know, what happened? Your body and your emotions ran away with you. Happens all the time. Every day we ask ourselves, hopefully not on very big issues, what made me do this? What made me do this? Similarly, what made me not do this? I had an opportunity to do something good. I had an opportunity to learn something important. I didn't do it. What is it? It's the psychological forces within us that make us do things that we shouldn't do and that prevent us from doing the things that we should do. I think St. Paul wrote about something like that already, you know. Sixth, humankind may be personified at times as Adam, who lies in a deep sleep of ignorance, his powers of spiritual self-awareness stupefied by materiality. Now we have, of course, the metaphor of the first chapter of Genesis. Seven, however, within each natural man is an inner man, inner person. This is a fallen spark of the divine substance. Since within each man this spark of holiness exists, the possibility of an awakening from the present stupefaction exists. In us is something that is the hope of our glory and the hope of our awakening. It isn't bestowed on us, it's in us already, but it needs to be awakened. Very true. Again, psychologically quite correct, would Jung say. Eight, what effects this awakening? Now this is quite important. What affects this awakening is not obedience, not faith, not good works, but knowingness, gnosis, spiritual knowledge. Now, of course, psychologically what this means is that our awakening to individuation is a process of consciousness. And the process of consciousness does not occur by believing something. It does not come by being obedient to somebody else. It doesn't come just by doing something good, although doing good is always useful. Consciousness is a reality in its own right. It is a sovereign thing. It works in its own way. It's not made to happen by external things, although it can be supported by external things. It's sort of like I know last night while I was going to sleep, I was watching some doggone thing, or some people in Egypt were trying to duplicate the way the Egyptians erected these big long obelisks. I don't know if some, I think it was on PBS, you know. They scraped out the sand and then, I mean, so it's kind of like this. You can do these external things and then you can prop them up and pull them in various ways. So that will help, but it does not build the consciousness itself. Ninth, before awakening, humans undergo troubled dreams. Before awakening to greater consciousness, we are involved in all kinds of illusory and yet seemingly very real psychological projections. Everything from believing like Hitler and his buddies did, and I know something about that because I was among them for a while, even though I was quite young, believing that a little bunch of people called the Jews are somehow the cause of all the evils in the world. I mean, how could anything be more idiotic? And yet, you know, millions of people believed in it implicitly, psychological projections. And others, all kinds of weird illusions, you know. Have you ever had even a minor anxiety attack? You know what that feels like? And maybe you are in your bedroom or something of that sort, and all of a sudden you start sweating and shaking, and you have this total overwhelming feeling that there's something awful in the next room. And yet at the same time your rational mind knows that there's nothing in the next room. Yet you are scared. What are you scared of? You're not scared of anything that's there, but you are scared of a psychological complex of a projection that has arisen and that leads at least part of you to believe that something horrible is right there. These are just sort of the more dramatic events, but they are there around us all the time. Until we awaken to a reality that is greater than these. And then they're sort of like the like the mists that disappear eventually, the fog that disappears when the sun begins to burn it off, they kind of creep away. The real consciousness comes and takes them away. Those are the troubled dreams. Then, the knowledge that awakens man from these dreams is not arrived at by intellectual cognition, but through revelatory experience, and is not an accession of information, but a modification of the entire being. About 5 2-hour lectures could be given about that one sentence. But as you know, these need to be kept in mind. Any kind of psychological insight, for instance, into your situation, is a revelatory experience. It's a revelatory. I don't mean that that's the only kind, but it certainly is one kind. If you ever had a real psychological insight that revealed something about your things in your life and why things have gone wrong or why you don't see things a certain way, it is a revelatory experience. And it's not the same as somebody just giving you information. It's something that comes to you and then it modifies your entire being. You're never the same again. 11, the awakening, that is the salvation of any individual, is a cosmic event. Now, of course, in the original Gnostic view, this was interpreted primarily by saying that every time an individual is enlightened, awakened, whatever you wish to call it, it helps to remedy the flaws in the external world as well, to some degree. Jung, however, would say that our own cosmos within which we live is remedied by more consciousness. And the more people there are around in any one place who are conscious, the better that part of the world becomes. That is the only really abiding way of improving the world. Because other improvements deteriorate in accordance with the unconsciousness of the people around. You give them a wonderful system of welfare or something of that sort, but it's all full of unconscious people. Give it a couple of years, they mess it up, it's going to be worse than it was before. We know how that works. But where there is consciousness, there is consciousness. Then everything is quite different. And finally, the last, the 12th, since the whole universal effort is to restore the wholeness and unity of the Godhead, active rebellion against the lesser systems, such as the Old Testament law and so, is generally enjoined on everyone. Well, this is probably a little bit of a misunderstanding, but I think still psychologically, if properly understood, it makes sense. It means that there has to be at some point an active dissatisfaction with the way things are, with you, with your consciousness, with your situation. If you always make excuses and say, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm a little bit unconscious, but so what? You know, whatever the case, you know. And you're not really convinced that you need to change, that you're never going to come into your own unless you have a greater kind of consciousness, then there is not going to be any change. So there has to be, at some point, a fairly radical dissatisfaction, in this case, with your own psychological condition before you can really apply yourself to a greater change. Not just, oh, well, it would be nice to individuate a little bit, so let's toddle down to the Jung Institute and see what can be done about it. You know, just sort of a blasé California laid-back motivation. That hardly ever does it. There has to be an almost a desperation about it. Well, all right, those are the 12 points that Clark Emery outlined, and I think it's fairly evident how, although they are taken from an ostensibly religious context, they can be very directly and very profitably applied to a psychological one. And so these are really the reasons why the Gnostic wisdom was such an important model for Jung's psychology, why he was so attached to it, why he valued it so much. And of course, as time went on, there were others, such as alchemy, and we'll take a look at some of those others in our couple of ensuing talks. So thanks very much, and see you next time.
Copyright MMI by DC Recordings, catalog number 100900. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.